The horrific events of yesterday demonstrate that, unfortunately, war crimes are going on in Syria.
This attack bears all the hallmarks of chemical weapons against its own people.
Yet another reminder, if we needed any, of the need for us to come together and put an end to this war.
We need a political solution to the conflict.
Chemical weapons as the worst of the war crimes, and whoever is responsible for that must be held accountable.
I don't think, again, we need to look at options at this point. I'm not going to get ahead of the president and the team. I think right now our concern is for the people of Syria and the victims of this attack. We have plenty of time to chart a way forward.
A suspected chemical attack in the northern rebel-held territory of Idlib, Syria, begins our coverage, killing scores of people. It's a brutal backdrop to a conference on international aid to Syria underway in Brussels today. Supporting the Future of Syria and the Region. It's the confusing title of the conference, which could easily be shorthand for the major challenge of this century: persistent regional wars, massive refugee disruptions across the globe, and trying to find a way to return war-torn nations to normalcy. Does President Trump have a stake in this conflict? Earlier this week, the White House said the ousting of Bashar al-Assad is not the focus of American efforts in Syria. The White House also condemned yesterday's chemical attack and pointed to former President Obama's fuzzy red lines when Syria used chemical weapons back in 2013. Robert Ford was U.S. ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He says there's no model in history for rebuilding a country without ending its civil war.
In order for reconstruction to begin, you have to have security. And with the exception of the inner city of Damascus, for example, most parts of the country still do not have security in the way we would understand it, so that you could have people come in and rebuild safely and bring materials in without having them stolen, hijacked. So there isn't going to be any reconstruction in the immediate future. There's still too much fighting going on.
There's really no precedent for this kind of nation building in the midst of war. I mean, yes, you're right. There's going to have to be some time taken here, but there's also going to have to be some authority that takes, for example, the security of Idlib, where the chemical attack took place this week. Who would be responsible for making sure that Idlib is secure so that reconstruction can begin there, let alone the downtown of Damascus?
Well, for example, the United States tried to rebuild Iraq starting in 2004 and 2005 and 2006 with tens of billions of American dollars. And the effort was largely unsuccessful because there wasn't security. A team from the World Bank in Washington has drawn up some initial estimates, back of the envelope estimates, that conclude that it'll take over $300 billion to rebuild Syria. And I think Assad understands he's not going to get anywhere near $300 billion. There's simply no source of financing that's going to come forward with that kind of money. And I frankly don't think he cares all that much about the reconstruction of some of the cities in the periphery. He's a man who repeatedly uses chemical weapons against civilians, is not particularly concerned about their economic welfare and whether their health clinics are rebuilt or their schools are reopened, et cetera, clean water, et cetera. I think he will be interested perhaps in rebuilding some of the inner cities of eastern Syria, which are in a sense his political base, his political stronghold along the Mediterranean coast. And the rest of the country, frankly, he doesn't care that much about. He doesn't control it anyway, and he's not likely to control it anytime soon.
Do you find it striking that here we are, this terrible, brutal, horrible war in Syria, and the responsibility somewhere in the region is to rebuild and to figure out what the future will be if this war ever ends? But the U.S. wasn't really involved in the discussions that took place in Turkey. There's no real leadership role for the U.S. in this Brussels conference. Does that represent a significant change. And we also don't know really the position of the Trump administration regarding Syria.
Well, I think we do know the position of the Trump administration regarding Syria, which is they don't care about the larger civil war between Assad and different opposition elements. They don't care about that. They do care about fighting one particular part of the civil war, which is the Islamic State part, but they don't connect that to the larger civil war. And of course, if you don't want to fight forever in Syria, if you don't want to, then you have to address the recruitment problem to extremist groups like the Islamic State. How do you undercut the recruitment? And I don't think there's any serious analyst who believes you can undercut the recruitment, stop the recruitment without addressing that broader civil war that involves Assad. And the American government has not played a serious role in that for months now. John Kerry tried last year up until the middle of the year. And now the Russians and the Iranians are driving this forward with occasional support from Turkey. But the Americans are playing no role, not in the ceasefire talks in Kazakhstan, fumblings, failing ceasefire talks, not in the United Nations-driven political discussions in Geneva. The Americans are basically absent. You mentioned this conference in Brussels as well on refinancing. The Americans are simply absent. And people like the United Nations envoy, a very talented diplomat named Stefan de Mistura, keep saying publicly, where are the Americans? The Americans are absent. But I don't think the Trump administration wants to get involved, and they certainly don't want to spend any money on the Syrian civil war, much less on the reconstruction.
Frightening scenarios sketched for the future of Syria by Robert Ford, former U.S. ambassador to Syria and senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, also a professor at Yale. He spoke to us from New Haven, Connecticut. Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
2 years ago in the halls of the United Nations, then UN Ambassador Samantha Power personally viewed a horrifying exhibit of photographs of dead and obviously tortured Syrian detainees whose lives ended in the worst way and recorded in the most grisly attempt to bureaucratize torture, something that may be the legacy of the Assad regime.
It's hard to find words after walking through that exhibit. Repulsive, outrageous, enraging. I mean, what can one say? This regime has no shame.
These photographs, some of which show dead detainees in Syrian military hospitals, are evidence of a vast abuse of a population, perhaps without precedent in Middle East history. Louisa Lovelock, Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, says the story of systematic torture within the walls of military hospitals in Syria is a massive-scale atrocity. She's conducted dozens of interviews and has firsthand testimony of a man named Mohsen El-Masri, a detainee and survivor of torture inside a hospital known simply as Number 601.
We decided to look at what happens inside Syria's army hospitals. These are facilities which really sit at the heart of what has become an industrialized system of torture. And what we found was really quite chilling. They're the best example of the way that the state bureaucracy has been brought in to serve what is effectively the Syrian state's torture machine. Doctors have abused patients in their beds, they've withheld life-saving treatment, and other times they've joined in the beatings. And then the Syrian government, in its own paper trail, shows that these hospitals are places where dead detainees nationwide are brought to be catalogued, often in an incredibly methodical way, and then trucked away for mass burial.
Why the methodical documentation of this torture?
When you go to the Syrian government's own paper trail, you know, it shows that they were issuing orders which acknowledged the upsurge in deaths. You know, they acknowledged that there was such a spike in the number of dead bodies coming out of detention facilities, coming out of these interrogations, that there had to be a system. You know, a system which they say in the documentation was meant to offer judicial immunity for the state, that you had to take the bodies to these hospitals, you had to photograph them methodically, and you had to write a medical report. Unfortunately, every single medical report says that the patient's heart stopped or that they had a stroke.
And in terms of the documentation that you've been able to see, any estimate of how many of the tortures actually lead to fatalities of individuals who are, you know, part of this, oh gosh, their heart stopped and we couldn't interrogate them anymore kind of thing?
Unfortunately not. I think the most interesting thing about this documentation is that if you read between the lines, it is an acceptance of the surge in the death rate. The reason these hospitals are important from a legal point of view is because they're also still in service for the treatment of serving military personnel. That means they're places where leading figures in the army have strolled around, often past bankloads of fridges filled with dead bodies, you know, spillover fridges sometimes outside of the hospitals. And under international law, there is a principle of command responsibility. This effectively says that even if you're not directly responsible for these aggressions, people in positions of power are criminally liable for abuses that take place on the watch if they were in a position to stop them and did not. And at this stage, there is absolutely no plausible argument that many war crimes lawyers can see that they could not have been aware about the systematic and industrialized torture that was going on their watch.
So depending upon how this all ends up, there would be a mountain of evidence of prosecution for all levels of senior officials in the Bashar al-Assad government.
There are mountains of evidence in particularly in private law firms in Europe. The problem is that there is no mechanism by which to put them into practice. The International Criminal Court would be one of the most common ways of going after people who have perpetrated these injustices, but that route is completely closed off due to the sort of very complicated politics which govern the Syrian conflict. So at this stage, the only way that this evidence and these case files can be put into place is in private prosecutions, and we're starting to see the first of them in Spain and now in Germany. So it will be interesting to see in the coming months and years whether or not individual figures in the military or indeed, you know, doctors from these hospitals who are now in the refugee flow and have arrived in Europe, whether they can be prosecuted on European soil.
Is it possible to give a sense of, again, the scale and the brutality of this story simply through the narrative of what happened to Mohsen al-Masri?
He ended up in Hospital 601, and what he described to us was a hospital where sick prisoners are tortured, lying shackled to beds crammed with dying men. The men are all naked, they're blindfolded, and when people die, they can be left for a whole day among the living. When people finally are allowed to go to the bathrooms in Hospital 601, this facility, which is about a half mile from President Bashar al-Assad's palace, they would find bodies stacked on the floors, often bodies that they recognized. And another person we interviewed said that in his case, the bodies were stacked above his eye level.
I just can't even, I mean, where does this sit in the history of this terribly troubled place in the world?
The media narrative on Syria is very focused on ISIS. You know, we've all seen the pictures of the, you know, of Westerners in orange jumpsuits being murdered by ISIS militants. But when you spend time working on the horrors that take place in Syrian custody, it's difficult to find a parallel for that brutality. The only difference is that it is underground, it is hidden, and you don't see the fruits of it until an exhibition like the one you referenced, the exhibition of the UN, of these, you know, these skeletal corpses with drill marks and burns. Until you see them, you don't know what's going on. And I think the most chilling thing of all this is it's not something that's in the past. This abuse is ongoing as we speak, and I think that is the most troubling part of this.
Louisa Lovelock is a Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, based in Beirut. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.